Hello, I'm Robert Bounds, and this is the Monocle Culture Show. As Oscar season ramps up, we're looking at one of the films that's in the running for lots of awards, Vice. This biopic is a comedic take on the life of former Vice President of the United States, Dick Cheney, who served under George W. Bush. Under, though, is up for interpretation. Cheney amassed more power and wielded it with greater stealth and ruthlessness than almost any president, let alone Vice President, before him. At least that's what this new film suggests. The time frame here, to refresh your memory, spans 9/11 and its fallout, the Second Gulf War and the War on Terror, and seems to lay the path for the partisanship and madness of much current American political discourse. The film is written and directed by Adam McKay, known for Anchorman, The Big Short, and his work on Saturday Night Live, and it stars Christian Bale, Amy Adams, Sam Rockwell, Steve Carell, and a lot of prosthetics. To discuss the film with me today, I'm joined in the studio by the film critic Karen Krizanovich and Monocle's very own silver screen-loving Ben Ryland. Ben and Karen, welcome to the programme. Lovely to have you here.
Lovely to be here, Rob.
On a lovely, bright Monday. We've just watched Vice, though. Are we feeling sad or are we feeling elated? Does it remind us of America when the baddies, at least, were in plain sight, Karen?
Yes, it did. I mean, number one, I'm surprised how much I enjoyed Vice because I thought it was going to be spoonful of medicine.
Yeah, 2.5 hours of Dick Cheney does not sound like a birthday party, does it?
No, it doesn't. You know, it's not as fun as The Economist. You know what I mean? But the fact is, and I think what's really interesting is McKay.
We had this discussion before we went live.
I eat haggis. I can't pronounce anything. There's wonderful.
You meant to swallow it first.
Okay. there's a wonderful interview with the director who said that Cheney is one of the most brilliant bureaucratic infighters in history, and he says he sees him as the Zelig-style figure of the right.
Right.
Which is exactly right. It's this sort of stealth. You know, like it's almost like. We're going to have a beautiful woman over here distracting us while somebody's working, you know, close magic with our money and our rights.
Mm. Distractions in politics. I can't imagine such a thing. Distractions being used as a political tool.
I know. Can you imagine? So this is done. We mentioned in the intro Anchorman, The Big Short, Saturday Night Live. It's a similar film to, thankfully, The Big Short rather than Anchorman, although one's brilliant and funny and one's just kind of serious. But kind of has its moments. So people might not know Adam McKay. Now it's happened. I can't get it out of my mind. Adam McKay's directorial style. Maybe you can fill us in on what this film, how this film looks, how it plays, some of the devices that he uses to tell his story.
Yeah, so it has an interesting sort of flow to it. And anyone who, like me, was walking into this thinking, oh God, I'm going to spend so much time with a character like Dick Cheney, I feel quite daunted. It's actually a lot of fun, and it does have a similar sort of tone to the Anchorman films, but the clever part about it is that it takes real history and sort of gives it a brand new coat of paint and makes it a lot more digestible. The style of the film is quite unexpected. It's a little bit like The Simpsons does politics, I suppose, in its tone, which makes it very, very accessible, but at the same time, it's a very angry film. You don't go into this thinking, oh, this is a level-handed approach at what politics is. No, this is clearly something that is coming at you to tell you, look at how terrible all of these people are. Look how successful these inhuman people without a moral compass, look how successful they can be simply because we don't pay enough attention. And there's a lot of little moments in the film that are clearly aimed at us, the viewer, because it's saying to you, while you were busy watching MTV, while you were busy looking at what Paris Hilton is doing before the days of Instagram, this is how bad the world was getting, and you didn't even know about it. So he does sort of guilt the audience a little bit as well, which is a very, very tricky thing to do because you can alienate your own audience, and yet somehow he doesn't because at the same time the film is just such good fun and enormously funny.
Let's take a clip so we can kind of get our listeners into the mood of this, remind us of some of the high points of it. This is a clip from Adam McKay's Vice.
I can handle the more mundane jobs, overseeing bureaucracy, military, energy, and foreign policy.
Yeah, right. I like that.
That was Christian Bale as, well, a sneaky old Dick Cheney. I'm speaking there to George W. Bush, who wanted him to be his running mate in that first fateful US presidential election. Yeah, so you can see there exactly kind of how Adam McKay kind of wants it to feel like the power behind the throne, the power in front of the power behind the throne. I don't know. Karen, do you kind of believe the story that he wielded this much power so sort of secretly and stealthily behind George W. Bush, and that this is how he got there? Not saying that this is full of factual inaccuracies, but the smoothness is obviously makes for a nice narrative. Do you think it was as easy for Cheney as the film makes out?
No, obviously, but I don't think politics is easy for anybody, even as stealthy and as smart as Cheney is. I mean, he's politically, his acumen is incredible. He's like a stiletto in a polyester suit, you know, scary guy. And I'm going to mistrust everybody who's boring from now on, particularly in the high office. But I think what's interesting about this is that we know that even documentaries can't tell the whole story, because the whole story doesn't fit into a narrative form usually. But I think from how McKay devised this film and how the script and the plot was laid out, I think it is more likely that it is true in parts, maybe truer than the history books will reflect. I'll give you one example, and that's who said to shoot down the planes and the passenger jets in 9/11 if they showed signs of being hijacked. Now, I took particular interest in that because I was in one of them at the time, and I'd heard that they were going to shoot us down, and I think like, what? And apparently there's no evidence that Cheney did say it, but also no evidence that he didn't.
And this is an interesting point, because this is where the film starts, in the operations room, the panic room, whatever you call it, during 9/11.
When the situation room, I think.
The situation room is the room that I'm looking for, blindly, without a key,
well,
Ben.
It could
thank
be called
you.
A panic room as well, I think.
Panic room, I think, is where you go once the situation room's been bombed, right?
Certainly if Bush is in there, it's a panic room.
So we revisit this then again at the end of the film. So it's kind of bookended by precisely this, that he's ordering those planes to be shot down, wielding absolute executive power. And there is something that is addressed in the narrative structure of the film and in one of these kind of expositional kind of skittish messing around, which is this thing called the unitary executive theory, which is a rereading, I think I'm right, of the second amendment to the Constitution. It means that if the president and therefore also the vice president somehow does it, it can't be illegal. So there is a lot of and of course that's the thing, at least in the screening I was in, a lot of the audience laughed or let out a stale breath of air that this obviously it feels like the present being written in the past, right? I mean, this in terms of the timing of this movie, what does it feel like? What did it feel like in your screening rooms or cinemas? Because this feels really like ramping up to Trump, doesn't it?
Oh, absolutely. The film exists in a Trumpian context. It's clearly meant to be read in that sort of way. But it also has a lot of connections to Trump. And I think one of the most important parts is that it actually, early in the film, we're starting off during the Nixon administration. And if you're watching this film and then you go home and watch some CNN like I did, then you start to look at this and realize, oh, hang on. You thought Nixon was like the end of that sort of style of politics. No, it was just the beginning. They're all still around. You know, those Dick Cheney started off in politics way back during the Nixon administration. Yeah. So did Donald Rumsfeld. Rumsfeld was one of the senior political aides during that administration. And yet they returned during the Bush administration, because as Cheney's character says in the film, and this is not spoiling anything, any Republican who was around during the Nixon administration who wasn't tarnished by the Watergate scandal is going to be worth their weight in gold now. That was his political reading, and he thought, this is my opportunity. Watergate doesn't matter at all. We can start all over again. And basically, that's just wiped all of those old political fogies off the table. And that's exactly what happened. Now, go home and watch CNN, and what's happening? Roger Stone is getting arrested, okay? Roger Stone, of course, started his career off in the Nixon administration. Who else? Roger Ailes. Roger Ailes is portrayed in this film very early on as well, for a brief fleeting moment. This film, it's not trying to take you back a few years. It's trying to alert you to what's happening right now.
Yeah, precisely. Roger Ailes, really interesting. His portrayal, as you said, brief in this movie. He pops up two or three times, doesn't he? And it's, I was trying to launch a conservative news channel. We
don't need that right now. And there are things, there are lines that are put in, that there are a lot of little tent pegs plotted around, sort of stuck through the plot to kind of bring your awareness up to why what is happening.
Remember the soft touch. Donald Rumsfeld comes back 20 years later and he's telling him, you need the soft touch in politics now, because we don't need to do the beating up on the street. Yeah. We've got Fox News to do that for us, Rumsfeld.
Yeah, it's really good. Let's talk about the players. Let's talk about the characters and the players. Christian Bale is Dick Cheney. Karen, I mean, I was convinced. He's got apparently he went to a trainer to get those big sort of, they would be a quarterback if the rest of the body matched it, right?
From the shoulders up,
a big man in a nasty slightly too small suit. You know, he kind of looks like a sort of he looks like Stay Puft from Ghostbusters, slightly roaming around, but softly. He treads softly. He kind of does everything very softly. How is Christian Bale as Dick Cheney?
I think that he's up for the top three examples of a double chin, prosthetic of double chin. I mean, you think about Darkest Hour, Stan and Ollie, and, you know, Vice. Those are three, the new Oscar for the double chin.
I love
that's
that you
a
have
good
your list
new
of category, that.
Karen.
Thank you. We'll do noses next.
Okay.
I really, at first I thought, is that him? You look and you think, where is Christian Bale?
Yeah, yeah.
He's under there. But it is an incredible performance, even though I was looking for the join most of the time.
Yeah.
And also pitted against somebody like Sam Rockwell.
Yeah.
And there's that one pivotal moment where Sam's like chewing on some barbecue going on, you're going to be my vice president?
Yeah.
And
pause the frame while he's getting some chicken down his chin, I think.
That was a great shot. Yeah.
And I'm just thinking, outside of hair and wardrobe, that was all Sam Rockwell doing Bush.
Yeah.
You know, whereas otherwise you've got you know, Christian Bale in a horse blanket and extra body fat.
He benefits from Cheney not being such a recognizable figure, right? We see him in pictures a lot, but you don't necessarily see him all over television giving speeches. Mm-hmm. One thing that I found quite jarring for me is that I've seen Christian Bale do Batman a lot. I'm a big fan of the Christopher Nolan Batman films. Dick Cheney's voice in this is Batman, but with a southern accent. That's it. And the minute he opens his mouth, you're thinking, hang on, this is Batman. That's Bruce Wayne.
Yeah.
Bruce Wayne got fat.
Yeah, okay. Yeah, there is a bit of that about it. He's got this strange thing, this pause that happens all the time. And he opens his mouth, much like our British listeners might remember how Gordon Brown, Chancellor and briefly Prime Minister under Blair, or with Blair, spoke, who has sort of having to breathe in every time he talks. So it's kind of giving him that kind of time to think. I don't know. It's obviously just how he spoke. I'm sure Christian Bale studied this very precisely. But that was a strange thing in the film. It was kind of like you were waiting for him to talk. Everyone had to sort of wait for him to talk. Everyone was asking permission. And he would then kind of inhale and then kind of talk as if the act of breathing in was him thinking. It's a kind of strange thing that I kind of noticed all the time, and I suppose it was kind of a trope of kind of making people slightly wait for him.
Well, that's
because he didn't do it in the beginning when he was serving under Rumsfeld. Steve Carell as
Steve
Donald
Carell.
Rumsfeld. Isn't he brilliant as Donald Rumsfeld?
Oh,
my problem was I really, really liked Donald Rumsfeld after the movie.
Wouldn't it be great if that's how he really was?
Yeah,
you know, it's like, you know, we hate him, but we like him.
Yeah.
And I think that's actually what Vice does. We hate them, but we like them. We see them. They're humanized.
Yeah.
And we can see, I mean, so much of politics is not only how you look. I mean, one of the reasons we don't know what Dick Cheney looks like is because he's not that handsome at this point. I mean, he's younger. Yeah.
Yeah.
I mean,
you know,
it's
when he
was out politics, there, Karen. None of them are that handsome.
Well,
really.
You know, helps, I suppose. But that's why a lot of actors like to go into politics, correct? But I think also the sense of gravitas and importance and charm. I mean, charm is so important.
Yeah.
Rumsfeld's got, he looks like a fun guy.
Yeah, he does.
As Steve Carell looks like a fun guy. I think that's one of the most interesting questions I think the film poses, is that what do you do if you are an incredibly ambitious, very, very intelligent, aspiring politician who is also just intolerable as a person?
You know,
the kind of person who has no charisma whatsoever. You walk into a party and most people don't even know that you were ever there. What do you do if you are that kind of person? Well, you become Dick Cheney. You become a puppet master. You work out how to control everyone else around you and work your way up to the top. It's got a very House of Cards sort of feel about it. You kind of get the feeling that perhaps the American version of House of Cards, back when it was good, had this idea that this is how politicians work when they're not charismatic. They simply break all the rules or bend them in their favour behind the scenes out of the public view.
Because there's such little scrutiny compared to the main man.
You render the election and the will of the people completely irrelevant to how much power you actually get to achieve in the end.
I think maybe this has been happening throughout the centuries. I mean, think of the palace eunuchs. You know, I mean, you're just being able to wield and also to manipulate people. And
this is right back to the prince. This is Machiavelli. Yeah, this is exactly all this stuff. I wanted also to ask you about his heart attacks that he keeps having.
Yeah.
So he's a man that's not, you know, he likes a decent supper. The film starts with him kind of driving his car off the road and down home Wyoming, and he becomes a reformed character. Amy Adams plays his wife Lynn Cheney, who kind of beats him around and gets him kind of on the road to recovery. I think he slightly overcompensates with things like the war on terror. Never mind. But he's obviously got a weak heart. This becomes one of the conceits that is kind of revealed right at the end. We won't spoil that, actually, the narrator and what role he plays. But his kind of underwhelming heart attacks. Dick Cheney travels so softly through the world of power that even when he has a heart attack, he does a stump speech when he's running for the House of Representatives or whatever. And has a heart attack on stage, but kind of stumbles to the ends of his speech and then just goes, I think I need an ambulance.
And then
another one, he's like, hi, gang. And he's kind of doing that prickly thing with his fingers, which I believe is the sign of an onset of
Yes, it is.
Okay, so he's kind of dispatched all his generals and he's like twiddling his fingers. I better get in an ambulance. And this kind of happens 3 or 4 times through the movie. And it's never less than very funny. Yeah,
exactly. The film very masterfully bends these things that could be quite dramatic, you know, in the hands of a more run-of-the-mill filmmaker, I suppose. These heart attacks could be, frightening moments. It's a chance to get in touch with Dick Cheney's humanity. No, Adam McKay is saying, don't go looking for humanity. There's none there. Yeah. This guy is completely inhuman. Even when he has a heart attack, he's not afraid of mortality because he sees himself as bigger than mortality itself. So you render these heart attack moments, and all of the moments, like the war on terror, all of these moments are just, that's all they are. They're moments. They're simply skittles that he has to knock over on the way to his goal in life, which is to achieve power for the sake of power.
But there is a historical element to this, that Teddy Roosevelt was giving a speech and shot, and he was shot and continued to finish the speech. So there is this element, I don't know if it happens in British politics or any other politics, I'm sure it probably does, that when you're up there, you know, you could be dying and you still finish that speech, which I think is very interesting. Also,
There's a great speech that Reagan did. I think Reagan was...
Oh, yes.
I don't know whether he was president. He wasn't governor of California. And there's a car backfires and he just goes, missed.
Missed me.
Yeah, it's really good.
I think I saw something. Yeah, not long after this, someone was posting the speech that he did just a few days after the attempt had been made. Yeah. And a balloon popped.
That's right. It was a balloon popping or something. Exactly. Yeah, it's very good. Yeah.
But this film actually informed the director when he had his heart attack as well.
Oh, is that right?
Because McKay had a heart attack afterwards. He'd said that he was smoking so much and put on so much weight while the stress of making this film that his personal trainer came to his house and just left.
That'll do it. I wonder if that was written in afterwards. You know what I mean? This has got a punning title. This movie, it's called Vice. We can see on both levels that works. Does it get under the skin of Dick Cheney, do you think? There's wonderful performances. There's a man who pads very softly through the corridors of power, and in fact builds those corridors of power, particularly around him. Do we know kind of who he is more at the beginning, at the end, than at the beginning, though, I wonder?
Well, as much as you possibly can. McKay says, you know, he's read his entire autobiography and learned nothing about him. So I think he's trying to show us the intangibility of this man.
I think that's the point that McKay is trying to make. Even at the very beginning of the film, again, not spoiling anything, there is a title screen that tells you that this is based on true events. I'm paraphrasing, of course, but it also points out that we can't possibly know everything about Dick Cheney because he's so incredibly secretive. And then this funny little line pops up at the bottom that, you know, but we tried our effing best.
Yeah.
So
the
film is telling you from the very outset, we don't know how much of
this guy's
is
as slippery as an eel.
Yeah. Exactly, but McKay is taking these things that actually happened, these things that maybe happened, a bunch of things that probably happened, but we can't be entirely sure, and he's portraying a character that he has essentially made up. It's based by very knowledgeable people on someone who actually exists. anyone going into this should understand that films are films. And I'm probably speaking mostly to Simon Jenkins, who is one of the opinion writers in The Guardian. He's written a piece called Fake History Films Like Vice and the Uncivil War Are the New Threat to Truth. Simon Jenkins, that is not what they are, because films, of course, are films. Now, all the way through this piece, which I think is incredibly irresponsible, actually, because it sets up a very phony idea of what films are supposed to be. And all the way through, he's saying that films don't have the same degree of responsibility when it comes to facts as newspapers would, and that if newspapers did what a film like Vice has done, they would be laughed off the screen. Well, that's entirely true, but they are very, very different things, aren't they? So, of course, this film is dramatized. Of course, all films about politics are going to be embellished, but that's because they're supposed to be dramatized for dramatic effect. They're entertainment. You can go into this film and learn a lot about politics, just not necessarily the facts.
The pinch of salt is always, I would always put that in my recipe.
Absolutely.
Right?
Yeah. I mean, it's immensely powerful to watch a film like this and go and Google what actually happened.
Yeah.
It will really, really turn out to be quite fascinating.
And that's what people will do when they see it. I mean, if they're interested. I mean, right. You can't stop people from watching film and going, well, it's the truth. They filmed the truth. You know, they're going to do that anyway.
There are a lot of devices that tell you this is not a documentary. Let's face it.
Even,
you've got a fake ending in the middle of it, right?
Even documentaries, you know, as I said before, somebody's running the camera. But as long as it piques interest, as long as it means somebody has a passing association with this name, Dick Cheney, then I think it's a good thing.
This is where we invite you. Mm-hmm. This is the part of the program near the end. We invite you to say what it reminded you of, or what it. I mean, Ben went off and looked, watched CNN to kind of. I don't know whether that's the kind of equivalent of having a nice warm bath after watching this movie, or the opposite. I put on The Power of Nightmares. It reminded me some of the structuring, some of the tricksiness, and the devices used remind me of The Power of Nightmares. Adam Curtis's first three films, where he looked at the war on terror and 9/11 and the basis of that. And I believe actually in The Guardian, the maligned so far in this programme Guardian, they had a double interview with Adam Curtis and Adam McKay about how they use stock images and how they use footage and how you do this in films and kind of create, with a nod to reality, create a kind of a different narrative and kind of thing. So that's kind of where, that's the first thing that I went off and thought about. And Oliver Stone's Nixon, Anthony Hopkins, which is an amazing performance, albeit a very serious and 3 hours and 11 minutes long film. Where did it lead, Karen? Where did it lead you off to? What merry woods did you skip through gaily after watching Vice?
You know, there's some nice things about having high mileage. Yeah. And it just reminded me of, you know, I had no interest in politics. I grew up in a really small town, middle of America, and you didn't want to get involved in that stuff. But when I started seeing European films, I started seeing really political ones, and one of them by Costa Gavras, starring Yves Montand, is called Z, and it looks like Zed, but Z means something in Greek. It's the verb for life, because anyway, don't get me started. But
get me started on ancient Greek.
Incredibly upsetting film. Where the assassination is the most shocking assassination I have ever seen. And then you start looking at something like The Jackal, or you start looking at something like The Mission, and they're all very serious. There's nothing funny about this stuff. And I think what's interesting is that now McKeon and others are making political films that have to be funny. Otherwise, number one, nobody's going to watch them. Number two, as he says, and this is a great quote, and I'm sorry to keep reading out quotes, but he says, the world has gotten so cartoonishly exaggerated and over the top, why be subtle anymore?
Yeah.
You know, we've got Trump in the office. Make jokes, because you got to laugh.
Right.
And number three, I also think it has to be entertaining. You have to. People will no longer go and be punished by a film, which I'm amazed by you going and watching, Ben, going and watching CNN. It'd be like taking your hair shirt off and beating yourself with a whip.
Not at all.
Michael Moore-ish in here, I thought, as well. We're straddling the difference between these two things.
I suppose, but Moore, I always find, is such an egotist. And I don't feel McKay. I mean, McKay started writing for Saturday Night Live in the 90s. He's a real cutting edge, very daring comic writer and director and producer. And I don't think that Moore really is like that. But I see what you mean. The energy and the juxtaposition, the editing is possibly similar.
The feeling of responsibility, I think, is shared between Michael Moore and Adam McKay. But I think Adam McKay has a much firmer grasp on the power of comedy to also communicate something that is very, very important. So you can laugh at something in Vice and find it hilariously funny, but also there's this other part of your brain that's saying, God, that's awful. I'm going to remember that and research that even more.
I think the great thing about McKay's background in comedy is that he knows when to give the audience a break. You're like, oh man, bad, important stuff. We're really worried. There's funny.
Yeah, there's a lot of I thought the good bits of this film were really good. The pacing, I kind of felt that the ending was coming a lot sooner than it did somehow. But then maybe that's because my reading of history is bereft, threadbare, like the carpet. Ben, you wanted to talk about a film from 1999 called Dick.
Yes, I'm pleased.
But it's about a different dick.
I'm pleased that you prefaced that as a film because there are a lot of...
Again differently, and I hope that Holly doesn't edit it out. Ben, you wanted to come on this program and just talk about dick.
That's what I was expecting. that's right. There is a film. This is actually tragically underseen, and it has a serious political element to it, but you wouldn't notice it on first viewing, I suspect. So basically, the premise of this film is Michelle Williams, Kirsten Dunst, quite early in their careers, I suppose, playing two silly blonde schoolgirls, high school girls, who go on a tour of the White House during the Nixon administration and accidentally wind up in this situation where they have unwittingly become the famous Deep Throat source. And you've got the two journalists from the Washington Post. One of them is played by Will Ferrell.
Right, okay.
Which gives you an idea of the tone that this film is striking. Nixon is played by Dan Hedaya. It's actually, he does an excellent performance. He gets the voice down pat.
He
just
sweats
perfectly.
Enough.
But what's so wonderful about this is that it shows these ridiculous moments of the president getting into all sorts of bizarre situations, such as the girls bring along some cookies for the president, but they've accidentally somehow wound up bringing the president cannabis cookies. So you've got Richard Nixon and Henry Kissinger eating these cannabis cookies, getting all high, and then descending into this rendition of the title song from Hello Dolly, which is it's completely bizarre. But then also it shows you that politics is actually ridiculous, childish, and a lot of the stuff that ends up making history happens merely through accident. And if you really knew the chaotic way in which a lot of these important decisions are made, we'd probably all be shocked. I mean, right now we probably wouldn't be shocked at all because it's on the front page of the New York Times every day. But this was made in 1999 when we thought things were a little bit more serious.
A little bit more wholesome.
Maybe.
Possibly.
Wholesome.
Well, we thought it maybe ended with Nixon. That's the thing, right?
That's the great fallacy. It's the great fallacy.
And that's what comes back in this one.
It's the great fallacy of Vice. You know, we all thought that the gremlins were weeded out at the end of Watergate, but they weren't. They always come back.
Roger Stone has a Nixon tattoo on his back.
Oh, man, I know. Oh,
I'll just leave that there. Oh, by the way, Robert, you're the only one here that isn't interested in talking about Dick. Loud man out.
okay, so it's a screening at mine. Karen's bringing Z. Ben's bringing Dick. Kirsten Dunst and Michelle Williams are more than welcome to bring the hash cookies. Vice is out in cinemas now. Thank you very much to my guests, Karen Krasanovich and Ben Rylan, and of course to my producer, Holly Fisher. Join us at the same time next week. For the time being, from me, Robert Bound, thank you very much for tuning in.